Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today, a little later in the show, we will be talking about how tech companies are influencing a lot more than you think in elections and otherwise. We're certainly also going to talk quite a bit about some of the controversial, quote-unquote, free speech issues sweeping the nation here, as well as the rise of white supremacist hate crimes and what that actually means. And, of course, we will briefly touch on the big news, which seems to be getting ready to take place here, reporting by many stations that Donald Trump will be pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, although I really suggest folks listen to our show from yesterday, the 31st of May, where we talked about this extensively. But before we can move on to all of that, the state of Ohio has joined the growing list of states and cities that are challenging the major pharmaceutical companies for their clearly abusive practices that have fueled the opioid epidemic, sweeping the country for the past few years. Ohio is another notable entry because the state leadership is made up of fairly conservative Republicans, and this is another sign that the anger over the opioid epidemic is appearing to take on something of a quote-unquote bipartisan nature. Mississippi, by the way, also a very conservative state, sued the pharmaceutical companies as well. West Virginia has already sued and reached some settlements, and some counties in that state have opened up some more litigation on this issue. The city of Chicago, cities in Washington state like Everett, counties in New York and California are all now taking on big pharma in the courts. The Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine stated in the lawsuit that big pharma is directly responsible for the use of strong painkillers in treating chronic pain and concealing the risks of the use of these painkillers. And they say, he said specifically, quote, millions of dollars on promotional materials, activities that falsely deny or trivialize the risk of opioids while overstating the benefits of using them for chronic pain. DeWine stated that major companies they are suing, like Purdue Pharma, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries, Johnson & Johnson, Endo Pharmaceuticals, Allergan as well, provided funding to doctors, medical societies, and patient advocacy groups to get them to support these pain-killing drugs. The lawsuit lays out how by 2012, opioid prescriptions in Ohio equaled 68 pills a year for every resident of the state, including children. Pretty massive scale there. It's worth noting here that Purdue Pharma has in the past already had to pay a $600 million settlement for misleading regulators, doctors, and patients as to the risks of OxyContin. We have presented multiple times on this show the vast range of evidence that exists around the role of big pharmaceutical companies, pill distributors, and pharmacies in this epidemic. Big Pharma deliberately lied about the risks of the drugs they were peddling there, paid people off to prescribe them and support them. The major pill distributors paid zero attention to the massive amount of painkillers being sent to certain areas, even when their own investigators were warning them about it in many cases. We also know that in 2013, the Obama-era Justice Department told the DEA to back off when they found clear leads implicating big pharmaceuticals in criminal activity as it concerns the opioid crisis. So now that the cat appears to be basically out of the bag and a large cross-section of local and state officials from both major parties are suing them, and with their PR in tatters, pharmaceuticals are looking for a lifeline. And it looks like they found one in the federal government. The National Institutes of Health and the National Institute on Drug Abuse just announced this week a new public-private partnership designed to develop drugs quickly in three specific areas: non-addictive medications for chronic pain, better treatments for opioid addiction, and improved methods of reversing opioid overdoses. So the federal government, which has so far mainly played the role of covering up for these companies, are now actually looking to help them get a double dip here. After creating this opioid crisis, which was massively profitable for them, Big Pharma wants to cash in by using government research dollars to make new drugs to deal with the results of the epidemic they caused. In other words, they bombed the cities, and now they want the reconstruction contracts. Well, don't expect them to do much more than some pretty shoddy rebuilding. Yesterday, in some pretty extensive comments about her race, Hillary Clinton again blamed almost everyone but herself and her closest campaign staff for her loss, part of a pattern by Clinton, Robbie Mook, and a few other insiders designed to mask their abject failure to beat Donald Trump and the clear missteps many have pointed out in their campaign strategy. However, Outside of just the usual list of people like Comey and Russia, Clinton added the DNC to the list of people to blame for her loss. She said she, quote, inherited nothing from the Democratic Party when she became the nominee, implying they were unprepared and outgunned by Republicans. She said specifically, quote, it was bankrupt. It was on the verge of insolvency. Its data was mediocre to poor, non-existent, wrong, end quote. Mm. And a lot of people were pretty shocked by this, given the great lengths the DNC went to help her both in the primary and the general. So as you might expect, this has driven a new rift in the Democratic Party, as many DNC staffers have been relatively upset by this turn of events. And, I mean, it shows the unbelievable sort of conceitedness on the part of Hillary Clinton. The director of data science for the DNC, Andrew Theriault, who he was the director of data science at the time, however, was not having it. He got very upset on Twitter. He used a number of expletives and said he wouldn't let people at the DNC be thrown under the bus, cryptically saying he would respond more fully in time. He stated that DNC models never had Michigan, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin looking safe for Clinton, but that the Clinton camp, quote, thought they knew better, and thus ignored those states. Theriault also noted that she had used the DNC to raise the massive amounts of money she did because the party committees can take higher donation limits, which makes it strange to say the DNC didn't do much to help her. Tom Bonier, who's a major Democratic Party data guru, also took exception. He took to Twitter to say, quote, for what it's worth, the data operation Clinton, quote, inherited was the most robust data operation the DNC has ever seen, including during the Obama reelect. He also noted, quote, one more thought, the Clinton team was using DNC data throughout the primary. If it was that bad, they knew that for 2 years but did nothing. John Hagner, another high-placed Democrat, he was the 2012 field director for the Senate Dems national effort there, noted that, quote, I work with DNC data every day last cycle on winning gubernatorial races. It was accurate and up-to-date, and I'm grateful for their hard work. I'll entertain any theories that targeting was off, but don't have a lot of time for people blaming the core DNC data file, end quote. Ultimately, this threatens to expose some rifts far beyond the media-driven, quote-unquote, Hillary-Bernie divide that everyone seems to want to be talking about. And as the DNC leak showed, even people supporting Clinton had doubts during the campaign about her strategy. Repeatedly, even her husband and former President Bill Clinton. The emerging story seems to be one of a tight coterie of campaign aides dedicated to Hillary, but with no organic connections to the people who vote for Democrats or desire to pursue a strategy aimed at mobilizing them in large numbers, as President Obama had done. And as one new book about the campaign notes, her campaign couldn't even figure out a reason why she was actually running. Yet rather than admit any of this or flawed strategies or the fact that she was really never that popular in the first place, Clinton is blaming everyone she can, from Russia to Comey. Now she's added the DNC to that list. Clearly, other top Democrats like Chuck Schumer aren't really on board with that, tried to make Schumer a pivot towards Bernie Sanders. Even Rahm Emanuel, the most pro-corporate of corporate Democrats, has been making some similar noises and sort of shading Clinton a little bit there. Obviously, the issues internal to the Democrats aren't going away, which has major implications for progressive politics, as the Democrats are seen by most people as the vehicle for those ideas. And the more it collapses internally, the more new possibilities emerge for a real politics aimed at eroding the power of profit and constructing a power for the people. Speaking of Russia and what has to be sort of just a strange development in the ongoing issue of the Russia probe, Republican Congressman Devin Nunes appears to be going a bit rogue here. After Nunes was more or less sidelined from leading the House investigation over accusations of impartiality, no one had really heard from him. The House Intelligence Committee that he had previously been leading up there appeared to be moving right along, with Trey Gowdy on the Republican side and Elijah Cummings on the Democratic side trying to present a united front in terms of how they were going to pursue this investigation, parallel to what was happening in the Senate and what Robert Mueller is doing at the Justice Department. However, without apparently discussing or clearing it with at least any of the Democrats, and maybe not anyone else or Republicans included on the committee, Nunes has issued subpoenas to investigate former UN Ambassador Samantha Power, former National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and former CIA Director John Brennan. The investigation is into whether or not those officials abused classified data and improperly unmasked the names of Americans whose data was collected during foreign intelligence activities. While what this all will amount to is still relatively unclear, it seems like the House investigation is getting ready to potentially collapse in on itself again due to this drama between Nunes, who, you know, whatever, appears to be partial to the White House version of events, and Democrats who have been trying to force him to play a lesser role. So something to keep an eye on. Sergeant Hugh Berry of the New York Police Department was charged Wednesday with murder, manslaughter, and criminally negligent homicide in the shooting death of Deborah Danner, a 66-year-old black woman with schizophrenia. Danner was well known to police as having mental illness issues, and in fact, 5 years before, she'd actually written a pretty good, interesting essay that spoke of her fears of being killed by the police due to suffering from schizophrenia. Berry had entered the apartment and gotten Danner to put down scissors that she was allegedly holding. He then claims, though, that, strangely, she swung a bat at his head. Now, despite knowing she was almost certainly suffering from some sort of episode, rather than deploy a taser or even just his own body, he fired two shots and killed her. A case reminiscent of the Eleanor Bumpers murder in 1984, where, believe it or not, a 66-year-old black woman who also had her own issues with mental illness was gunned down in her apartment by an officer who was later acquitted of manslaughter charges and which still evokes strong feelings from the black community in New York even today. Whether Berry will face any real consequences is yet to be seen, but certainly he deserved these charges, in my opinion. And on a related note, the city of Milwaukee voted today to pay out a $2.5 million settlement, or yesterday I should say, to the family of Dontre Hamilton, a 31-year-old black man sleeping on a park bench who also was suffering from schizophrenia. The officer who was never charged claimed self-defense, but the reality is he pumped 14 bullets into Hamilton during a scuffle, which is a pretty clear sign to me he was not acting out of self-defense. Hamilton had not been violent at all. In fact, the police had only been called because people thought Hamilton might be in distress. He was sleeping on a park bench. People were worried about him. Two officers had already previously come, checked him out, found that he was fine. This guy shows up, decides to wake him up, pat him down, push Hamilton into an episode of sorts, caused him to resist the officer. The fact that turned into his murder, though, is completely absurd. And that the officer faced no charges, also absurd. It's just clear yet again here, the police have a bias problem in this country towards people of color, the mentally ill, and LGBTQ communities. And that's why these same people are routinely brutalized and mistreated and killed at disproportionate levels. And unfortunately, the so-called justice system just covers for the cops. And those are today's talking points. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are happy to be joined here as we continue our conversation by George Cicciarello-Marr, who's a writer, radical political theorist, and a professor of politics, and also Sputnik News analyst Bob Schlee-Hubert. Thank you both for joining the show.
Glad to be on here.
Thanks for having us.
We're going to move on to another topic, but I guess the big issue right now, the big sort of breaking news is President Trump is going to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. Lots of different views on that. Anyone who's interested, like I said earlier in the beginning of the show, definitely listen to the show we did yesterday. We had quite a bit on that. Lots to be said. But before we move on, since it's a big political issue, I want to just offer folks a chance to say something. I don't know, George, how you're looking at this. I know, you know, you've been around the world. I don't know if there's something recently, if the climate agreement, the Paris Climate Agreement, is the pullout by Trump has any significance to you at all?
I mean, it's, of course, utterly absurd, especially given the fact that the Paris Agreement is so moderate that it is really not even nearly significant enough for what's necessary. And here he is pulling out. I think what's more important, though, more relevant, is the fact that he's able to do so in a populist way, right? And this, you started talking about Hillary Clinton, and this points directly toward the utter uselessness of the Democratic Party and the fact that this person, who, of course, represents the worst aspects of global capitalism, you know, embodies those, personifies those, nevertheless can stand up and say that some kind of national capitalism is what's going to save working class, people in the United States. And to have that argument have some traction, I think, talks also about the failures of those, you know, attempting to counter him.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. Bob Schlee-Hubert, Sputnik News analyst, your thoughts on this pullout by Trump of the Paris Climate Agreement?
Yeah, I mean, and it comes on a day, I guess, with just as, or maybe not as newsworthy, but as newsworthy to several of us in the environmental movement, is the Dakota Access Pipeline went online today. And once we talk about these actual building of these pipelines, this is constructed, set there. I mean, this infrastructure is now there. This isn't rhetoric. This isn't talk. This isn't some tweet that Donald Trump sent. This is a pipeline that is now moving crude oil across our country over water sources that are vital to the future of our planet. And these accords him pulling out is just more consistency on this. So I think those two events happening simultaneously today is telling of where the battle will be around the environment over the next few years. And there's a protest. Anybody in the greater Washington, D.C. area listening to this, there's a large protest and response in front of the White House from 5 to 6 o'clock, which will really show. I mean, obviously, Trump has quite a bit of support for this across the country. He campaigned on it. It got huge applause lines. And now we'll see the reaction from the community of activists here in the D.C. area to see if there is a groundswell that's immediately responding to this and see what the reaction is from the United States over the next few days here.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, I tend to agree with George on this. I mean, the agreement itself was so it was not even enough. James Hansen, the famous climate scientist, called it a fraud. And so just in and of itself, I think it gives us another opportunity to discuss how little was already happening. America was already behind. I think really the way people should really view this is in the context of everything Trump had been doing around the environment and the way it's coming out, not necessarily the agreement itself. But nevertheless, there's a lot more to that. We talked about it a lot yesterday, so I'm just going to move on from that issue because there's a lot of other things that happen that fly deeply under the radar in this country. Yesterday, the Portland attack guy was in court, many people covering his utterances while he was there. To me, George, it seems like, though, there's still sort of a conspiracy of silence around this issue of white supremacist violence. I mean, I think obviously when I look at this guy, he may have some other things going on from a mental health perspective, but everything, it just sort of like all the things he's saying, the bigoted, hateful things are being pushed to the side and be like, oh, well, he's just crazy. And that no one really wants to own up to the fact that this actually is a major issue in America.
Absolutely. And you know, we're talking about a moment in which there's a huge uptick in white supremacist violence, in open white supremacist attacks, multiple just in the last week. And people don't really want to confront that question. And what's really interesting, and I was sort of half joking about it on Twitter, is that, of course, he's in the courtroom talking about his free speech. Right. Mm. And that sounds absurd. Right. And it is absurd. And so you consider the fact that he was actually engaging in hate speech on that bus. Right. Mm. And so there are a lot of people who want to stand up and say, well, no, we don't want to police people's speech. We don't even want to police Nazi speech or white supremacist speech or hateful speech. And yet at what point does he move from engaging in free speech that people don't want to police to actually attacking and killing people? Right. We're talking about a matter of split seconds, and no one really wants to own that, you know, that argument in this moment. They want to talk about free speech when it comes to Ann Coulter or Milo Yiannopoulos, and yet they don't want to, you know, own up to the fact that not only the attacks in Portland, but the fact that Kianga Yamada Taylor is now receiving racist, hateful threats on the base of a commencement address that she gave at Hampshire College. And no one really wants to step up and talk about speech when it comes to, you know, to her and to this uptick, dramatic uptick, in an open and brazen white supremacy. And more importantly, and I think we'll get to this in a few minutes, what it would take to fight this.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, and we're about to go to break, but just so people know, Dr. Yamada Taylor is a professor of African-American studies at Princeton University, just put out a new book as well, I think called something that Black Lives Matter, Civil Rights to Black Lives Matter, one of them. It's a good book. People should read it. Check it out. But yeah, just vicious, vicious, vicious attacks and threats on her and on her family as well. But, you know, no huge outcry from, you know, any of the so-called civil libertarians that are out there and allegedly policing these issues, be that as it may. So obviously a major uptick, obviously things happening. We want to talk more on this. So we're going to take a break here, but we're going to come back with more on this topic here on By Any Means Necessary and Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing our conversation today around, you know, quote unquote, free speech issues and how it's intersecting with the issue of white supremacist violence here in the United States and a couple other things as well. We continue to be joined by George Cicciarella-Marr, who's a writer, radical political theorist, and professor of politics, and Bob Schlee-Huber, who's a Sputnik News analyst. And to pick up quickly one point you made there towards the end, George, that I think is so relevant in terms of what is the line between speech and action is, I said to someone yesterday, I said, so even if this guy is totally quote unquote crazy, whatever the problems with that word, like, how is this something he's latching onto? I mean, it's not like this is randomly in the ether and he just thought it up. Like, obviously, there's much more, I think, sort of white supremacist, violent type of imagery that exists in our society that permeates a lot of what we do. And so regardless of this individual person's mental state, I think it speaks very heavily to how deeply inculcated these ideas are in our society. So one person's speech, you know, is another person's reason to kill two people.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And, you know, you mentioned Kianga Yamada Taylor's book From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. This is actually a really essential text when it comes to understanding really what has happened in the past 40 years. Because what has happened is that the, you know, entire narrative and discourse of the United States has been effectively taken over. It was originally a strategy of the Republican Party. The Democrats embraced it entirely. This idea that we exist in a colorblind society. And the flip side of this idea is that anyone who demands equality, in other words, black and brown people, poor people, demanding equality are actually demanding special privileges. And this creates and feeds into a narrative of resentment and a feeling of white victimization, which has become, you know, very prevalent today and has everything to do with the election of Donald Trump. The idea that the people that, in like literally the people who have always controlled the United States, those who benefit the most from the institutionalized structures of the United States, somehow consider themselves to be the victims of something today. And they call it a whole lot of different things. But when that's in the air, right, when that is the prevailing sentiment, when your life is not going the way that you want it to be, or things are going wrong, or, you know, you're having difficulties in certain ways and you're looking for scapegoats, there's a scapegoat that exists for you to grab onto, to latch onto. And the alt-right and all these movements that are emerging are very effectively taking advantage of this, right? People, you know, you even when it comes to the question of misogyny, taking advantage of the fact that these kind of young white dudes feel like they can't pick up girls, so they, you know, decide to turn into raving misogynists and come up with theories about why this is. And this is really, really crucial for understanding what is going on. And as you put it, for not falling into these easy arguments that on the one hand demonize mental illness as though mentally ill people are going around being white supremacists all the time, and also you know, allows us to just brutally miss the point when it comes to what's going on in our society today.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's a great point, and it leads us to our next point as well, which you had mentioned a little earlier. So, which is, I think, how people respond to this. And so this weekend, it looks like in Portland, there's a group of these white supremacists who are going to try to march, trying to gather people, I think, from the region and maybe even around the country. At this point, the mayor of Portland, I guess because it starts at a federal park, is now calling on the federal government to ban this march. Now, I'm of the sort of school that the bans are a slippery slope. You ban these people, next thing you know, they're going to start banning socialist, communist, anarchists. But nevertheless, this is roiling. So I'm curious your thoughts. Should they ban this march in Portland?
I mean, listen, just as a general rule, I'm always more in favor of people on the streets making these marches impossible than I am, you know, of them demanding that the state do it for you, right? One is an expression of the power and of the people rejecting these kind of movements. And another is appealing to this state apparatus that's really never going to do us any favors. Maybe we need to do that defensively, right? I don't want the Klan to march. I think, for example, when the ACLU stands up and spends so much time defending the right of the Klan or the Nazis to march, that says something about liberal values and the way that they can lead us down a very, very dangerous path. So I think people should mobilize and should shut these things down. If the mayor wants to ban it, really, that's you know, up to him. I think the arguments against banning it, though, you know, rely on this absurd idea that, you know, that speech is somehow separate from action. Mm-hmm. And that, in particular, racist speech, in other words, speech which is premised on the fact that entire groups of people are inferior, and as a side note, therefore, their speech doesn't matter as much and isn't as valid, you know, that is not violent in and of itself, right? That this kind of speech is not provoking, encouraging, participating in broader structures of violence, which it is. And I don't think it's easy. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's easy to determine where speech ends and violence begins, or how the two are entirely entwined with each other. But I actually think we shouldn't be looking for easy answers to these questions. And I think it's a cop-out for the people that say, oh, no, we can't police speech in any way. Because you know what? We always do, right? Mm. You had Kathy Griffin apologizing for, you know, holding up a fake, you know, beheaded image of Trump.
Right.
When, first of all, we should remember that if she had done that 1 year ago, everyone would have been laughing about it. right? And suddenly this is verboten. Suddenly this is, you know, she's forced to apologize, and the liberal media apparatus is forcing her to apologize and calling it, you know, disgusting.
Mm-hmm. No, I think including her so-called, you know, best bud or whatever, Anderson Cooper, on some, and I think the issue of the sort of office of the presidency and the reverence we give that is relevant. You know, I think there's also a philosophical issue about this, the issue of bans. But before I get to that, Bob Schlehuber, I just wanted to see if you had thoughts on the particular issue. And I believe this march now maybe has been moved to Seattle. But either way, whether or not the idea of a government banning a march like this, do you think would be fruitful or not?
I don't know. I mean, again, it's that tricky, blurred line. I do want to kind of go back. I think it's a really fascinating phenomenon of what the professor was saying beforehand about how a lot of white people have been turned into the victims in situations where they're the perpetrator. If we look at the Betty Shelby case, Terrence Crutcher made her kill him. It wasn't her action. It wasn't anything she'd done, but somehow the narrative got spun that Terrence Crutcher had scared her so much that she was now the victim. Same thing with, we talked about on the show a lot, the Freddie Gray case, right? Makes it sound like Freddie Gray is on trial. So even in these situations, and maybe I'll pivot to then say, well, a lot of these Black Lives Matter protests have police surveillance and firefighters rolling through taking pictures of everyone there. So the government has no problem of infringing on those freedom of speech actions. And so as much as the conversation shouldn't maybe be, well, should the government interfere or not? Let's look at what the government is doing to current protests and current movements right now and let that be our starting point. So sure, yeah, these KKK members, these white supremacists, they can march, and the kind of debates of, well, should we allow them to march? Shouldn't they march? Well, they're marching. They're out there. They're at these monuments as they're being pulled down from the South all over. That's happening right now. And we know then protesters of the Black Lives Matter movement, they're having their photos taken. They're being surveilled. They're being followed. Police are using scare tactics. So let's just start at the facts there and then kind of debate from there. Past that, I don't know where those lines are. I think it's a really good starting point for a better conversation when we're more real with what's currently happening.
Well, I think it's a good point. And it raises to me a slightly more abstract point, George. And maybe you could say it's philosophical. I don't know if I would say that. But either way, it's sort of like the power relate. Because I think that there's two different conversations that people are having. I think there's one conversation which is in the context of a capitalist, imperialist America and the nature of the state and the ruling class and everything we know, should the government ban marches of anyone on that basis? Like, what are the implications of that? That's one conversation. But it seems to me that especially the people who are protesting these speakers are really raising a separate question, to me at least, even if it's not fully conscious, which is, in a society in the abstract, like in a government, in a society the way we would like to have it or would want to have it or whatever it may be, how would we then regulate speech? How would we deal with hate speech? How would we deal with educating people and putting things out there? Which I think is an extraordinarily valid question, because I think it speaks to the issue of, is liberal democracy, quote unquote, the only form of sort of small d, quote unquote, democracy of human beings living and working collectively together that can even exist? And what are the rules around that? And it's so essentialized where, okay, if you don't support Nazis speaking, then you don't support the right to free speech, which seems like crazy. And it just seems like there's almost two separate arguments that deserve to be had kind of in their own space.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm not a liberal Democrat. You know, that's, I think that won't be shocking to anyone. But many European countries that are entirely liberal democratic countries, you know, have stricter codes on speech, right? In particular, countries that have experienced fascism and Nazism have, you know, stricter guidelines when it comes to whether or not you know, the Holocaust denial is, you know, allowed, whether or not, you know, Nazi organizing is allowed. And that doesn't mean they're not liberal democracies, right? I think that's, you know, one of the first points is that, you know, every country has a certain understanding of how speech should operate. It just happens that in the United States, we have a particularly strong one. But what we end up doing is actually just confusing the point so thoroughly when we're dealing with these debates. And what's most frustrating is when this happens, you know, on the so-called left, or, you know, the liberal, you know, the liberals masquerading as left around, for example, Ann Coulter, right? Who, as we now know, based on the way that the whole thing turned out, was actually not a question of free speech. It was a question of access to a university platform and a fat paycheck. In other words, precisely those structures of power that determine and have determined whose speech matters from the beginning. Milo Yiannopoulos, again, you know, paycheck, you know, a huge book deal that he had before Berkeley. We're talking about people who are actually finding their speech privileged and are gaining access to privileged platforms, which no one has a right to. The First Amendment gives no one a right and guaranteed access to, you know, to speak on a university campus, much less to be paid to, you know, to give those speeches. So we need to separate out these questions. And it's not always easy, but again, we need to engage in the in these hard questions. Academic freedom is one thing. The, you know, the First Amendment, free speech, you know, your right is another. And then as you raised the very important question of, is this really the way we need to be thinking about these things? Or is it really a question of understanding the historical moment that we're in and understanding what it would take to fight Nazism and fight fascism and prevent it by any means from really emerging to begin with? You know, do people who believe in fundamental biological cultural inequalities, do they have a right to say anything? Mm. Or and much less, do they have a right to say anything without being directly countered, shut down, in, you know, by whatever means?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I'm glad you actually raised the issue of privileged spaces, because I often feel like the whole conversation is held in such a strange thing where it's like, oh, Ann Coulter, like her right to speak. I mean, it seems like in some ways it's actually the exact opposite, because even though she didn't speak at Berkeley, I mean, she can go and speak. I mean, if you look at talk radio, for instance, we're on top radio, you know, the top like three or four of them are all Republicans: Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, tens of millions of people, Glenn Beck, Mark Levin. She could go on all those shows, Laura Ingraham, speak on all of them for hours, have millions of people here. As you stated, she's getting book deals and things like that. She's definitely going to go on Fox News all day and maybe even get on CNN or one of those as like a little bonus. And so in some ways, like, she has the most access to the media and the ability to speak. And the BDS people on campus or whatever, people like yourself who have been attacked on issues like this, you know, you can't just call up CNN and say, hey, I'm going to go on Anderson Cooper. And so the power imbalance is so unbelievable here, yet it never really enters into the conversation. And I wonder if it's because, to some degree, to me, a lot of these liberal critics don't really want to raise the issue of power because they have to then raise the issue of capitalism.
Right. And what they're doing that's even more troubling, I think, is, I mean, and this is not, you know, I'm not the first one, of course, to notice this pivot from demonizing Trump to embracing him as president, right? Mm. And so these very same people who don't want to talk about their power and their privilege are actually themselves contributing to this by accepting the existing framings, by whitewashing the Trump administration as somehow legitimate or acceptable, or having political views that might be debatable when they're not, and refusing to really, you know, take even what they said was their own line. In other words, when they were saying, you know, the Democrats were saying Trump was a proto-fascist, all this stuff. Well, you know what you do with fascists? You hang them by their heels upside down under a bridge, like they did with Mussolini. If you really believed that, then you wouldn't be now saying that it's some kind of, you know, criminal offense to, you know, to engage in a comical, you know, send up of, you know, of a beheaded, you know, president. Mm-hmm. And so we need to understand, I think, the way in which not only is it the case that they don't want to reflect on their own power in the media, but they're actively doing what liberals always do, which is to just open the gates, you know, for white supremacists, for racists, to, you know, whitewash them, to let them in the studio, to let them on Bill Maher, for example, when Milo Yiannopoulos was invited on, and to make this acceptable, to translate it into mainstream, you know, into mainstream terms. And this is a powerfully dangerous thing that's happening.
Yeah, well, Bob, I think that's an extraordinarily important point, and it speaks to something we talk about a lot on this show, and Bob Schlegel, also the producer of the show, does a great job, which is the Democrats' inability to actually help form an effective, you know, sort of opposition here. I think George makes a good point. Everyone running around saying fascism, 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 and we're the resistance. But like the French resistance was like shooting people on the street and sabotaging industry. You know what I mean? And so if, you know, it's just like you're sort of trying to capture this image in this moment, even the whole like Star Wars Rebel Alliance thing, which I don't even really like that, but like the Rebel Alliance is like blowing up planets and raiding people. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like a totally different level of actual resistance that you claim the mantle to while directing people to just like vote in 2018 and like, you know, sign impeachment petition.
No, I guess I wanted to kind of separate two things. One, the media and its relationship with kind of the resistance has been just a complete joke, and it's completely insulting to anybody that is listening to them. I think of just kind of the ways in which they go after Trump is around this. We were saying the other day about the homophobia, him and like kissing Putin. Well, you're being homophobic now with trying to like be funny to resist Trump, or the same thing with the golden showers or the body shaming. It's all these like weird things that they're attacking him on. So it's not a very like deep, thoughtful analysis of how to be able to push back on some of these issues. And a lot of comedians are running with this fodder. So yeah, Kathy Griffin probably went, she did go too far in my opinion, but the whole liberal comedian joke thing has gotten super old, and it's very distasteful, and it's not critical or actually talking about different issues that we want to look at. As for the Democrats at a political apparatus, ever since that gun sit-in that John Lewis led last year, and they made this huge deal about this new gun law, we're going to do something, we're going to take the lead, and they simply were tying the gun background checks to the terrorist no-fly list, which showed again that the party's more interested in, yeah, Star Wars and marketing and big showmanship and big celebrities and lightsabers and special effects. They're not interested in serious policy changes because, again, you're looking at issues of capitalism. You're looking at issues of criminal justice. You're looking at meaningful actions on the environment. You're looking at a whole host of policies that we're not even educated as a society to even come close to addressing. And then you have a completely unrepresented Congress and Senate that doesn't represent the American people based on all of the polls that have done on basically any foreign policy issue. They're way more conservative and hawkish than the average American, and on fiscal issues as well. And then they're going to lead the resistance. I don't buy it. And every time you watch it, you can just see it's complete theatrics. And so, yeah, I'm lost at follow who to follow, because as George is saying, they're not credible and serious if they're going to call people fascists because they're not taking it to the level that it requires. And on the other end of things, they're just being theatrical and looking for votes.
Yeah, no, well, I think the looking for votes is so key. And I think just the way you see it play out, I mean, whether it was the I think it was the DNC guidance on Black Lives Matter during the primary or whatever, which was like, meet with them, but don't ever agree to anything they say. Or even yesterday, Ben Jealous, you know, the black guy, former head of the NAACP, so-called progressive, or not so-called, I'll give him that. You know, he's on the board of Our Revolution or whatever. And I'm looking at his speech, and it's like basically cool. And then when he addresses the rising crime, quote unquote, rising murders in Baltimore, he's like, we're going to deal with this. We're going to lock up the shooters. Well, wait a second. You were one of the people who's been saying for the past like 8 years that that was not the solution to criminal justice issues. But now you're worried you're not going to get votes out in Frederick, Maryland, and then you make these kind of, I don't know how to even look at it, George, but like you make these compromises just to get these votes at the lowest common denominator, not realizing you can be reinforcing some of the worst possible tendencies in doing it, or maybe realizing it and not caring.
Yeah, I mean, and not only are you not realizing that, but you're actually undermining your own self, right? I mean, look at how Hillary did, right? And many of us knew, we didn't know what the outcome of the election was going to be, but we knew where the weaknesses were. And the weakness of this kind of mealy-mouthed liberal pragmatism has become totally clear. Not only in terms of just losing elections and being utterly out of touch with, you know, with the people that you need to get to vote for you, but also with rolling over and accepting essentially what were Republican talking points over the past 30 years, embracing them, bringing them into the Democratic Party, giving up on any kind of base and any kind of struggle. And the reality is these political leaders are not going to do anything when movements are not holding their feet to the fire, when they're not pressuring them, when they're not pushing them. So, of course, over the past few years, there's a huge transformation in the narrative around mass incarceration to the point where it seemed as though we were going to be able to begin decarcerating, right, in large numbers and transforming the system and closing prisons and changing the way that people talk about crime and about drug addiction, for example. And yet, suddenly Trump's elected. The attorney general presses this sort of hard line that sounds like it's just going to lock up more people. And so-called progressives are rolling over and accepting it because they think that somehow it represents the tenor of the populace.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great point. We're going to have to leave it there, though. That was George Chicharella-Mara. Please check out all of his work everywhere you can. We are going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about the type of influence on elections and other things that other people aren't talking about, so not what you might expect. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Dr. Robert Epstein, who's a psychologist, professor, author, and journalist. Dr. Epstein, thank you for joining us again.
Pleasure to be here, Eugene.
Pleasure is all ours. And I wanted to start here with something we talked a little bit about before, but, you know, seeing Mark Zuckerberg be so much in the news past couple days for his Harvard commitment speech, it reminded me of the sort of brief little kerfluffle in the campaign. I think it was actually towards the tail end of right after the primary was over, about whether or not Facebook was trying to manipulate the election or whether they should, and that some people inside the company were pushing them to do more of it. And I think there's a lot in there, but I just wanted to start by sort of framing this discussion by saying, I mean, how possible is it technically for these big tech companies like a Facebook or like a Google to actually sort of sway an election?
Well, it's really quite simple for them to do. A few years ago, a colleague and I discovered an effect we call SEME, S-E-M-E, which stands for Search Engine Manipulation Effect. And we learned about the power of search results to influence votes and opinions. And the numbers we were getting were literally more than 10 times bigger than we thought we would get. I mean, it's one of the largest effects ever discovered in the behavioral sciences. And this effect is very dangerous because it's invisible to people. And since that time, I've been studying, including that, four different types of influence on the internet, which are brand new, have never existed before in human history, are entirely invisible to people, and are extremely powerful ways to shift votes, opinions, purchases, beliefs, attitudes, without people knowing. And Facebook and Google, those are the platforms that have the most control over these techniques. Google more than anyone else, but Facebook also has some control over these new techniques. And they're wild. I can tell you, they're unlike, and they have nothing to do with fake news. Mm. Nothing. Fake news is just silly. It's a distraction. Because the real threats are much bigger and invisible. Fake news, that you can see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm glad you raised that because this actually came up, Facebook's role in the election and fake news and Hillary Clinton's, I don't even know, little speech, talk, interview, whatever it was yesterday about the reason her campaign lost. So I wanted to play a little clip from that before I got to my next question, which digs a little deeper on that point. So we're going to take a listen to Secretary Clinton here now.
So if I put myself in the position of running a platform like Facebook, first of all, they've got to get back to trying to curate it more effectively, put me out of the equation. They've got to help prevent fake news from creating a new reality that does influence how people, you know, think of themselves, see the world, the decisions that they make. I don't know enough about what they could have done in real time. It wasn't like we were not having conversations with them because a lot of the people on my team were.
And Dr. Epstein, I wanted to play that clip, the last little bit too about their relations with Facebook. Interesting. But I wanted to play that clip in particular because of the issue you just raised, which is I think the way most people think about the issue of being manipulated online is in the context of this, you know, fake news, these fake stories that they're being, whoever's doing it is like forcing them to read and changing their mind or whatever it may be. So I was hoping you could dig a little deeper. And I mean, what is the difference between what you're talking about in terms of influence, which I think is very important, and this sort of whole sort of fake news controversy?
Well, let me put this in context for you. This is very, very easy to put in context and really to understand what's going on. And what the difference is between fake news and really powerful methods of influence. Okay, fake news stories, the main impact they have is on people who already believe certain things. So in other words, they confirm the beliefs that people already have. So you're not going to impress me with a fake news story that doesn't match my beliefs. I would just laugh it off. That's what we all do. With all of the stimuli, all the information we're being bombarded with, we pretty much ignore or just cast aside anything we don't already agree with or believe in. And this is called confirmation bias. And that's how fake news works. No one has ever shown that you can use fake news to flip an election. So, let's compare, however, things, powers that Facebook has that are much, much, much more dangerous than allowing fake news stories to proliferate. Number one, this is true. In fact, the New York Times did an article about this. During the period when people were supposed to be registering to vote, Facebook ran a huge campaign urging people to register to vote, and they were giving people details to make it easy for people to register to vote, even to do so online right through Facebook. Well, the New York Times determined that because of Facebook's audience, because of their membership, what this did was this caused disproportionately large numbers of young people, mainly Democrats, to register to vote. Now imagine, let's take that a step further. Imagine if Facebook were sending out those reminders only to Democrats, which they can do because they know all about us. They know who are the Democrats, who are the Republicans. They know who supports which candidate. Imagine if they were sending out those reminders selectively. We would have no way of knowing that they were doing so, and they could literally get millions of Democrats to register to vote who otherwise would not have, and no one would know about that manipulation. Now, let me take it one step further, and then I promise I'll shut up. We know from a published study that Facebook was involved with, this was done with people from Facebook and a university, and published in 2012, we know that if on Election Day itself, Facebook chose to send out go-out-and-vote reminders just to supporters of one candidate, if they did that on November 8th of last year, that would cause possibly as many as a million people to go out and vote that day who otherwise would have stayed home, and no one would know that they did that. And if you can cause, I'm just saying, if you could cause a million people to go out and vote for your candidate, that causes a vote margin of 2 million. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge, and it's invisible. I mean, come on, fake news compared to manipulations of that nature, there's no comparison.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's unbelievable in some ways. And I guess my follow-up question is, I mean, is it legal for these companies to do? I mean, this seems like extreme manipulation of people.
Is it legal? Yes, it is legal. In fact, I published an article about five different manipulations that Facebook has at its disposal to flip elections. I published an article in Quartz a few months ago, so if people want to look that up, they can find it. And it is legal. It's not legal because it should be legal. It's legal because our regulators and our legislators simply haven't caught up. My team is one of the only teams right now in the country that's even studying these things.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all new. It's not. I mean, the techniques are fairly new, but also the discovery of them is new, and the studying of them is new. So the regulators and legislators might never catch up, frankly, because these techniques just keep multiplying. We're talking about a new world, new technology, new ways of influencing people that have never existed before in human history. And the ways that Facebook has to manipulate are nothing compared to the techniques that Google has at its disposal, or even places like, believe it or not, like Tinder. So there's a lot going on here that we're getting distracted. We're getting distracted with this fake news stuff, with the Cambridge Analytica stories, which have been bombarding the media. And they're just distractions. Believe me, the real stuff is much scarier.
No, I think that's a very good point. And I mean, certainly we also have the information about, Facebook manipulating people's emotions. But on that issue of Google, too, I mean, in terms of, especially as it concerns the issue of quote unquote news consumption, it seems to me the bigger issue isn't necessarily, you know, quote unquote fake news as if a story is false, but a sort of winnowing out or an algorithm that constructs the news you want to have at the top. It all is quote unquote real news. The news you want to have at the top, as opposed to what may in fact be the most relevant in terms of what's out there. I mean, that seems like, if people are worried about news consumption and this power, that's the bigger issue to me. It seems like the ability to manipulate how people consume events by manipulating what are the top sources. I mean, I think everyone who looks at Google, just about who I know, you just click on the first, you know what I mean? Like the first five things or whatever seems relevant.
Right. And they have total control over the list, right?
Mm-hmm.
That list of certain, and there are phenomena which people have been studying for more than 100 years that are called list effects. So what's higher in a list generally, you know, has more power than something lower in a list, that kind of thing. But we're talking about new kinds of list effects, again, that have no precedent. The power of Google search results to influence us is truly extraordinary and truly unprecedented, because it's not just any old list. It's a different kind of list that's never existed before, because most of the searches that we conduct are just routine searches for simple facts. What is the capital of Nigeria? And when you conduct a routine search, the correct answer always ends up in the first position. So we are like rats in a Skinner box, being conditioned over and over again to believe that what's at the top of the list is better and truer. So this isn't just a list effect. This is a list effect being supplemented with a daily regimen of operant conditioning. So again, there's never been anything like this. But you're right. These lists that we see, the news feeds on Facebook, even the search suggestions you get on Google, that list of suggestions that pops up when you start to type a search term, those are all lists. And these companies have total control over those lists, over what they show you first, second, and third. And therefore, they have total control over what you're going to click on. And therefore, they have total control over what you're going to read. And that's where the influence is just enormous. And people are just oblivious. You know, they think, okay, all this stuff is coming to me from an algorithm, so it's objective. Mm. It is, it somehow rises above human manipulations because it's coming from a computer. And people just don't question it. They say, okay, it must be true. In fact, there have actually been studies showing that people trust, the information they're getting from these companies more than they trust any newspapers, any radio shows, any billboards. Because there, the human element is very obvious. Mm. But when computers are shoving information at you, you can't see any kind of bias or favoritism. And you assume that there is none, and that's false.
I mean, it seems like the impact of this on, what at least many people would consider the sort of quote unquote, the idea of democracy seems to be relatively huge. I mean, it seems like for any president or Congress or group of politicians, there's a huge incentive to sort of, cabalize yourself with some of these forces in Silicon Valley to try, as opposed to regulate them, to try to influence your own opportunity to be returned to power over and over again.
Well, yes, and of course, there's overwhelming evidence that the Clinton campaign was closely allied with a number of the big companies in Silicon Valley. The co-founder of Facebook donated, I think, either $20 or $25 million to the Democrats just a couple of months before Election Day. People have tabulated, where the donations went to from Silicon Valley to the Republicans and Democrats. And of course, overwhelmingly, the donations were going to the Democrats. So yes, what you want to do is align yourself, team up with one or two, preferably two of these big companies. And that's going to get you a lot of votes. Now, of course, in this case, what happened was, although those connections were made, it wasn't enough. No one anticipated the kind of craziness of of our election system and of the Electoral College in particular. So it wasn't enough. So even though those connections gave Hillary Clinton a lot of extra votes, I mean, she won the popular vote by almost 3 million. More than 2 million, as far as I'm concerned, came from manipulations of the sort I've been describing. It wasn't enough because of the Electoral College. So, there's no guarantees here. But yes, you do want to hook up with those companies, and you do want them using all of these perfectly legal means to manipulate people without their knowing. And that's the system we have right now.
Yeah, and I mean, do you think that the government in and of itself, I mean, sort of the flip side of that coin, a lot of people say, well, tech companies have this, sort of profit incentive to keep your stuff private from the government or whatever because, whatever, you won't buy something if it is what it is. I mean, I'm curious your thoughts about that sort of connection, if there is sort of if that symbiosis could be somehow disrupted, by tech companies feeling like the government is consistently making it difficult for them to gain consumer confidence.
Well, this gets a little tricky, but the point is, if you go ahead and read Google's terms of service, which I have multiple times, you will find that Google reserves the right to share the data they collect about us with pretty much anyone. And they do share the data, and we know this, of course, from Edward Snowden's revelation. They do share the data with other companies. In their terms of service, it's called their partners, who are unspecified. And they share them with government agencies around the world. So the data that is being collected, those are being shared, and they're being shared with government, and they're being shared with other companies. They're being sold. And again, that's the system currently that we have. Cambridge Analytica, for example, the massive database that they used to help put Trump into office, they got that data by purchasing it from data brokers, and they claim to have more than 5,000 data points, meaning, pieces of information about every single adult American, a lot of which, as they say, they just purchased. and then use that to try to manipulate votes, you know, in November. We live in a system of massive surveillance. We live in a system in which the information that's collected is being shared in ways that we just don't know about, but the data definitely are being shared. And that's what we've got right now. And we have no restrictions, no legal restrictions, no regulatory restrictions on any of this activity. It's potentially so dangerous. I'll just give you one quick example here. That's one thing that we've looked at, that my research team has looked at. Google, when they give you suggestions for what to search for, Google will never show you negative suggestions for Google. So Google Bing Yahoo will also show you negative search suggestions for Google, Bing, and Yahoo. But Google will never show you negative search suggestions for Google. So in other words, the mind control machine is actually manipulating what we believe about the mind control machine. And that's the system we have right now. It's incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, and that seems incredibly true, especially because, I mean, it's an extraordinarily small, sort of tight-knit, relatively homogeneous group of people with control over all of this, which in and of itself to me seems like that's a problem. I mean, not that it wouldn't be if it was maybe like more people, 20 times more, but I don't know. It just seems bad either way.
And by the way, I am not a conspiracy theorist. I'm sorry, but I'm not. And I'm not even close. But, you know, as there's an old saying, there's a fine line between paranoia, and that's conspiracy theorist, and caution. And what I think we have to be here is not paranoid, but we sure as heck have to be cautious. We have to recognize that these techniques exist. We have to study these techniques. And we have to, at some point, try to take steps to protect ourselves from these new manipulations. And, you know, again, that's what I'm focused on with laser beam precision. And I'm finding these techniques and then finding out how they work. And, of course, now also we're developing systems to monitor what these big tech companies are showing people, which is another step in the process. So, you know, it's going to be a big battle. It's going to take a long time. I don't think we're entirely helpless, but on the other hand,
it's definitely an uphill battle there.
Uphill battle.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Epstein. As always, very, very interesting research that you are doing. This is Dr. Robert Epstein. Definitely check out all his work. That is going to do it for us here today on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.